This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on a special bonus episode of Meatin' 3, we're celebrating Mardi Gras with an ode to the king cake, the most delicious custom of carnival season.
This is kind of like terrible comparison, but it's kind of like a braided New Orleans babka, if you really think about the actual technique of it.
Do we know why they put a baby in the cake yet?
You'd better be careful where you get that cake, because your friends and coworkers in New Orleans are going to have an opinion about it.
Tune in to Meatin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, this is Lisa Held coming to you live from Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Today, my guest is Jamie Ager, the farmer and CEO behind Hickory Nut Gap Meats, calling in from his farm in North Carolina. Jamie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, let's start with where you are. Can you kind of paint us a picture of where in North Carolina the farm is located and what the landscape's like out there?
Sure. So we're my family farm is located about 20 minutes southeast of Asheville, North Carolina, which is in the southern Appalachian Mountains. And so we're definitely in a mountainous region, the western part of North Carolina. And, you know, it's a bottomland valley, that comes up against three mountains, Little Pisgah Mountain, Tater Knob, and, Ferguson Mountain. And so, this is where I spent pretty much my whole life is right here at Hickory Nut Gap.
Wow. And, so you've been there pretty much your whole life. The farm has been in your family for about 100 years. Is that right?
Yeah, my great-grandparents moved here in 1916.
Wow.
And so my great-grandfather was a Presbyterian minister they were married in 1916, and they were coming through Western North Carolina on their honeymoon, and they found the farm.
And that was how it all started.
That was how it all started.
So were they farmers?
No, he was a minister, and he actually had gone to Yale, and he had just found a wife, which was a real asset for him. He was kind of having a hard time, you know, like a lot of Presbyterians. There was a lot of shame and guilt, and he was struggling a little bit emotionally, but he found a wonderful lady who had been studying art in France with Monet, and he ended up coming through Western North Carolina on their honeymoon. And, you know, Western North Carolina in 1916 was a pretty destitute economic environment to be in, you know, the South, and the sort of Appalachian stereotypes that are out there are primarily due to sort of economic doldrums of post-Civil War South.
Right.
And whenever he came to Western North Carolina, as an educated guy who was of the ministry, so he had a service orientation towards things. And he sort of realized that there wasn't a lot of economic development as far as agriculture went. And so he sort of recognized the need to get organized and create a farmer's co-op. And so that was essentially his life's work, was an organization called the Farmers Federation.
Right. And but first he started farming, yeah?
Yeah, totally. Had apples and various different farming enterprises.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. So, because we're going to get to what you do now, which is more focused on meat. But it wasn't always livestock. It was sort of different. There were different iterations of the farm along the way.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think at one point I read it was a dairy farm as well, right?
Yes. And you know, I sort of. It's a typical sort of small Appalachian farm where there's You know, we've never been in a row crop situation here because scale was never really an option with the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the history of the production of the farm is that there was, they were kind of trying lots of different things in the 20s and the 30s. And then World War II came and the farm became a dairy like so many other small scale dairies throughout, you know, the Southern Appalachian Mountains at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a dairy here. We grew tobacco. Apples have always been a part of our farming heritage here. And, you know, always had some beef cattle. He brought some Hereford cattle down from Shelburne Farms outside of just south of Burlington, Vermont, with whenever he first moved here, too. So he was very interested in sort of and improving the economic life for farmers.
Right. Well, yeah, let's go back. Let's talk about the Farmers Federation. I'm so intrigued by this. So you said that was sort of his life work. How exactly did it work?
So that's a good question, and I wish I knew exactly how it worked. But essentially,
maybe not exactly. That's asking a lot. Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, they sold shares, and he would actually go to New York with all of his banking buddies.
Hmm.
And raise money every so often. They would basically build feed and seeds all over Western North. He had a Federation store where varieties or those type things.
What you called it did you say feed and seed?
Basically a feed and seed.
Can you explain what that is for a listener who might not know?
Sure. So in most rural communities, there's like the feed store,
right,
or the seed store, another farm wares that you might need. And basically that store is the hub of innovation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially back in that era, whenever there weren't a lot of options out there. And so, every community or every county had a feed and seed where they would sell newer varieties, and then they would also had a marketing arm, and they built hatcheries here in Western North Carolina. They were basically in the, you know, marketing business as well as the supply business for farmers, and so they sort of helped start a broiler industry here. We have an old chicken house here on the farm that my mom still takes care of all the time, and you know, it's a 1930s style chicken house with a big run that was exactly how it was intended to be in 1930.
Wow.
And so, you know, and his mission was basically to help drive economic development to the more rural counties in Western North Carolina.
Right. Like sort of economic development that was in the hands of the farmers themselves, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I was just reading a little bit about Farmers Federation, and one thing I read said that it got really big, that it was like 3,500 members at one point. I'm curious if you know why it went out of business.
Well, you know, it was a co-op, and so co-ops were very popular in the 20s and 30s.
Mm.
Along with that movement, the Farmers Federation, you know, thrived. Obviously, there was a need for some coordinated organization, and to a large degree, I think it was his kind of effort that helped drive it. Post-World War II agriculture, as we all know, was a time of concentration and aggregation and scale. And so, as the 60s came about, I think it became more and more apparent to the board of directors that it was no longer, you know, either had to get really big or they had to sort of combine with other cooperatives. And so, and I know it was a very contentious time, to be honest. I know my grandmother, talking to her, she was younger, you know, at that time, she was probably in her 40s. And, when it collapsed and, It was the bedrock of a lot of communities.
Yeah.
And so, it was, you know, they had picnics every summer where all the people would come and they would have a string band play and then they would introduce some new corn variety, and sounded like a really fun fun thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was kind of way back in the history. Let's fast forward a little bit. So what year did you end up taking over the farm?
So I was born in 1977. And I, you know, we had the dairy when I was a child.
Okay.
And we sold the dairy when I was about 12, is my memory. And that was a big deal. And I certainly remember the frustrations of being in the 80s and watching the sort of economic part of the dairy just not work.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, you can pay attention to that stuff as a child and
right.
know that. And so, when we sold the dairy in either 19, I think it was the fall of 89. And then I was 12 or 13, you know, I was getting ready to turn 13 and I was really interested in, you know, I was through my high school years. We still had the farm. And so my mom kind of helped run it at that point. She was really in charge. And so we just made a ton of hay every summer. And I have three brothers and a bunch of cousins. And so we all essentially spent our summers and after school time working on the farm and just kind of holding it together. It didn't really have to pay anybody's salary necessarily at that point. It was more just to, you know, if there's grass, you got to have cows out there to eat it. And if there's cows, you got to have fences. And that's essentially what we managed and maintained. And so, and as I got older and older, I loved it. I loved being out there. I loved the, I mean, at work, I'm not going to say I loved it as a kid because that would be like, oh, sometimes it was hard and I didn't like it.
Yeah.
But the older I got, the more I appreciated the farm. And then I ended up going to Warren Wilson College, just up the road here in Swannanoa, and studied, really got interested in, you know, and my parents were back to the Landers.
Mm-hmm.
We had chickens. So I was always doing chickens. We grew a big garden in the summer. So We were selling a lot of our eggs to the food co-ops in Asheville. So I was born with an idealism around food and eating healthy and agriculture and all that.
Right.
But in a really realistic way, not in a sort of naive
way. Yeah, right. You knew what it really looked like.
Yeah. And you know, our neighbors were the editors of Mother Earth News magazine.
Wow.
So that was the kind of people we were around.
Huh.
And so once I got to college, I was interested in all these things. And then I basically just ended up really studying ag. 1998, Joel Salatin had written his books. Actually, visited Joel Salatin's farm with a girl that I was interested in and she had been worked there. And so we went up there for the weekend and had a great time. And that just kind of opened my eyes to this whole concept of direct marketing and, you know, local meat and all that. And we were just, you know, the family farm was 20 minutes from Asheville. So it was a very easy for us to do that. And Warren Wilson, the college at the time, was beginning to direct market their beef off the farm. And my wife, my girlfriend at the time, a year or two later, who's now my wife of 19 years, was doing a lot of the marketing for that.
Ah.
And so she and I wrote a business plan for our senior, you know, class and said, hey, let's make this work. And so we graduated as young, idealistic college students ready to change the world. And now I'm 42 and have two teenagers and we're still idealistic and ready to change the world.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems to be going really well. So you had this, from the get-go, you wanted to do pastured meats. That was sort of the plan.
That was my plan for what I thought. You know, the farm is kind of a rolling farm. I really liked beef cows.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made a lot of sense to do pasture-raised meats.
Yeah.
And so, that first year, I raised some chickens, some turkeys, and, you know, we finished four or five beef cows and sold them by the quarters, and we did, you know, maybe five pigs, and really just kind of built a lot of infrastructure on the farm also. We had to build a bunch of fence and fence all the cows out of all the creeks, and that gave us the ability to kind of put a bunch of infrastructure in, which is a perfect job for a 22-year-old young, you know, guy out of college who wants to use his body and work hard.
Right. So what does the farm look like today? Like, what kinds of animals do you have? Sort of paint us a picture of the operation.
So we are a, so the operation today is certified organic land base for beef cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And so we raise, you know, about 40 to 50 certified organic cattle every year. And we raise probably close to 250 to 300 hogs a year on the farm. That we have a butcher shop here at the farm and a little deli as well that's open 5 days a week for most of the year, and then 7 days a week in the fall. We do a corn maze and a pumpkin patch.
Mm.
But we have a little farm store, and really our mission here today is we've gotten more clear with who we are as a company and really built ourselves into a more organized organization,
mm-hmm.
which is feat in and of itself. But our mission is to build communities through agriculture. And what we mean by that is the whole supply chain, what duck is, from soil health to animal health at the end of the day.
Oh, you cut
and,
out.
And
you
agriculture.
Jamie, you cut out a little there. Can you say that last part again?
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's community health. Mm. You know, it's our mission is to build community through agriculture, which means that we really just want to make sure that we pay attention and incentivize good soil health practices, good welfare practices for the animals, you know, healthy food for healthy people, and just build a model and a system where the correct things can be incentivized throughout that supply chain so that we can actually have an impact on agriculture that is more farmer friendly and more based on, you know, triple bottom line economics.
Right. Well, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about what some of those practices are and a little bit more about how you're working with other farmers. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
All right, we're back. I'm Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report. I've been talking to Jamie Ager from Hickory Nut Gap Meats. So right before the break, Jamie, you were talking a little bit about how you at the farm have an overall mission to really kind of incentivize a certain kind of agriculture. I think you said, you know, the correct, do things the correct way and think about community health. When you think about what that looks like, what are some of the practices you're talking about? You know, how do you do this the correct way?
So, you know, the correct way to me is looking at, you know, at the end of the day, the question is, what is sustainability, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we encompass the entire supply chain to think about sustainability comprehensively? And to me, you know, biodiversity is the answer.
Mm.
And how do we build biodiverse production models that are soil enhancing, essentially? And so, you know, with beef cattle, for instance, we practice a lot of rotational grazing, mob grazing, adaptive grazing. It's funny to see all the different versions of of the same concepts of rotation, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so that concept has been the fundamental side of our beef cattle operation. And the nice thing about being down here in the Southeast is that, you know, we have the ability to have more of a year-round supply of 100% grass-fed cattle, because we can work with farmers in the low country of South Carolina and Georgia, as well as farmers in the Southern Appalachian Mountains in the summertime. So we really have the ability to create a year-round supply of 100% grass-fed cattle. So that's essentially the beef side. For the pigs, what we do is all the pigs are pasture-raised pigs. And so we put them out in the woods or on the edge of a pasture where we have a lot of, at our farm, it's Multiflora rose is the primary non-native exotic species. And just let the pigs have at it, right? Beat it up, tear it up, rip it up, and then we'll cover crop behind it with whatever's appropriate for that time of the year. Right now we've got some wheat growing that we planted last fall that's doing beautiful. We've got the pigs on a pasture that we're going to actually convert, pig pasture that we're going to convert over to a cattle pasture and cover crop that this spring. So just really thinking about when you do, you know, pigs are obviously going to be rooting a lot, but make sure we pay attention to soil health. All that fertility that they drop and leave behind, we can utilize as part of a cover crop and build soils and then have a killer place for them to come back into as well.
Right, absolutely. And
so those are the sort of regenerative practices. You know, we also raise some pastured hogs here at the farm still. We do about 300 turkeys a year. And so we just rotate those around the pastures.
Right. And you mentioned other farmers too. So tell me a little bit about that. Now you don't just have your farm. You're also sourcing meat from other farms in the region and then marketing it all as Hickory Nut Gap meats.
Yes. So I ended up, about 4 years in of direct marketing and going to farmers markets in Asheville, and we had our first son in 2004, and I realized that, you know, we weren't going to be able to grow as the market kept growing. We kept selling to more and more chefs in Asheville, and Asheville was kind of a really early adopter to the local food movement. And so, you know, and it was just kind of working out. And then there was this natural food store that opened in Asheville, and I ended up taking an ag leadership class through NC State, where I got to go down to travel to Raleigh with a bunch of other farmers from across the state. And I was the only kind of weird organic guy in the class. But, you know, I got along with everybody just fine and had a good time. And you know, a lot of times I feel like I'm, you know, most of my life is just farming, right? That's the majority of what we do. So it's no big deal to hang out with other folks just that are operating in a different economic environment.
Yeah.
And so basically realized that one of the farmers that I was in the class with, Sam Dobson, was a dairy farmer in Iredell County, which is about 2 hours from us. And they had a dairy farm where they were doing a bunch of grazing. And Sam and I got to be good friends. And I'd sort of sleep at his house before we went all the way down the next morning for the class. And we just got to be good friends. And about this same time, a new health food store opened up in Asheville that was pretty big. And they were wanting our beef.
Okay.
And I was just like, we're not going to have enough fresh beef for that. It was busy. And so Sam just started doing like two steers a week. And we started selling that. And then he had some neighbors. And, you know, this area is just a good area to raise grass-fed beef. We've got a lot of ryegrass around here, a lot of triticale, a lot of clovers. It's doable. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just kind of kept growing that out. And then that health food store got bought by Whole Foods. And so then then Whole Foods had the whole Global Animal Partnership GAP program. So we learned what that was like and started working with them on that. So it just slowly but surely added on. And I'm a networker. I like people. I like to go visit farms. And, I enjoyed my trips. And there was other, factors in that, even it connects back to the Federation days, I'd say, because, you know, my family is generally known in this region.
Yeah.
And my grandfather actually ended up in the U.S. House throughout the 80s here. And so, you know, like a farmer, Bass Hyatt, and he's in Clay County, knew of my family, knew I was Jamie Clark's grandson. They're good people. We'll work with them, you know?
Yeah.
And so these relationships matter, you know?
Yeah.
The older you get, you realize sort of you're just a byproduct of your people.
Yeah.
And so, it just kind of kept growing, and we kept learning what that looked like, and really just trying to understand it from a farmer's standpoint. And that's really been my motivation the whole time, is like, there's all these trendy words like grass-fed and organic and all this stuff that the marketplace is incentivizing. But agriculture is way too complicated to be described in just one word,
whatever
that label claim is. And so we'll check boxes if we have to check boxes, because obviously you have to do that if you're going to be in business. But at the end of the day, you know, we decided that we were just going to build a brand, because we were in the sales and marketing business. And once you're in the sales and marketing business, branding is just, you know, human beings only have the capacity to think so much. And branding really helps, you know, encapsulate a concept into an organized emotional experience, I guess is the best way to put it. And so, you know, we realized after we were doing that a little bit, I'm like, we really need to organize this. And also, it was me out running around selling meat every week, and just me realizing that that was going to wear me out. We had a 2-year-old at that point. We had another one on the way, and I just said, doing this. And so we built a brand, and just sort of one, you know, 15 years of doing that, and it just kind of slowly but surely builds. And you know, we've managed to, the big challenge in the meat business, and now that we're in the actual meat business, you know, the big issue is utilization, because you have to move that whole carcass every single week. And so we have to really pay attention to that piece. The margins are tight. It's hard to be in the meat business. And it's one of the reasons I think that it's tended to get scaled so much.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, part of the deal.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really fascinating that, you know, it almost seems that, you know, you said that like the Farmers Federation kind of ended because that was sort of a product of its time, the co-op model. And it almost seems like this, maybe what you're doing, building a brand that incentivizes certain, you know, practices that are good for the environment and good for the people eating the meat, and then allows farmers to, you know, farmers in your region to, you know, gain financially, and you know, maybe they're struggling because they have a dairy operation, and now they can be part of Hickory Nut Gap Meats and make more money. And it's almost maybe this kind of like building a brand like this is the modern version of something like Farmers Federation, right?
Yeah, I'd say that's there's a time for everything, and I think the time is now for, you know, regenerative pasture-based livestock production models that are going to be, you know, a solution to the greatest problem of many generations, which is climate change.
Right.
And so, to me, that's what's really gotten me excited lately, is just seeing that we are sitting on a real solutions-oriented production model that's just really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and back to the economics for a second. You know, I'm curious, how, you know, is it difficult to make the financial aspect of this kind of production work when you're up against, you know, obviously most meat is not produced in this way. Most is produced in systems that make it very, very cheap, and you're kind of selling against that. How has it been in terms of like trying to make this a successful business in this?
Well, when there's a lot of companies like us that Whole Foods really created because they buy the whole carcasses, and that really sort of locks in a margin.
Wow, right? I didn't know that. Whole Foods buys the whole carcass from you?
Well, they used to, and they would still, but we decided to
go to business with Whole Foods more as a meat company.
Okay.
But we still pay a lot of attention to utilization in our conversations there. But they have done that. Like, there's small brands that they'll just buy the whole load, because farmers don't have a cooler and a freezer and inventory systems and all the really expensive equipment and infrastructure to do that with. And so, so from an economic standpoint, you know, you're looking at, in the meat business, you're looking at gross margins, 15 to 20%, something like that. So it's a pretty small load, and it's a fresh product, and it's heavy, and you've got to, you know, you're talking about live animals, and it's all pretty intense, right?
Yeah.
It's a real thing. And so, when I look at an item like Impossible Burger, I'm like, wow, what a great idea. Big gross margins, all processed food, incredible storage.
Right.
Much easier for the economic system of capitalism to manage. No wonder there's so much marketing behind that thing.
Right.
So meat, I think meat's just, you know, it's been such a scaled enterprise for the past 50 years because of all the infrastructure requirements, the shelf life, the processing logistics, the scale of the processing, everything. And I'm, you know, sort of a person who looks for that sweet spot in a business and wants to find a good economic model that we're not having to, you know, scale all the way. But it's difficult to find, to be honest, in the meat space.
Absolutely. Where exactly are you selling? Like, is it just in North Carolina? Is it sort of regional? How far out do you go?
We sell currently, North Carolina is definitely the majority of our business.
Okay.
South Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina is pretty close. Charlotte is big for us. Atlanta, we sell quite a bit of product into Atlanta currently.
Okay.
We're about 3.5 hours from Atlanta. And then, trying to think where else. That's the majority of it, to be honest. Oh, New York. We saw a little bit into New York that just started.
Huh.
Not yet quite, but we're almost there. It's going to happen. We're excited about that. So, you know, and we're about 50-50. We work with retailers like Whole Foods, Ingles, Supermarket. We did sell to Earth Fare, but they recently went out of business, which was unfortunate. And then we also work with distributors for food service, like U.S. Foods, Inland Seafoods, Sysco, and that was primarily driven by, you know, accounts that we had sold to in Asheville locally, and then they decided to grow the restaurants, and so we just followed those. They wanted to get it through U.S. Foods, and I was like, sure, let's figure it out. We'll set up the codes, and there's a whole bureaucracy there that we just kind of figured out.
Yeah, well, that's great. And then if you get in there, then that gives you access to other places that are using those companies, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And then you can go to a Sysco food show and talk to folks and really sort of help drive the conversation.
Absolutely.
About local food and pasture-based agriculture.
Absolutely. Well, Jamie, we have to wrap up in a minute, but before we go, I forgot to ask you one important question, which is, tell me about the name of the farm and the company. I want to know why it's called Hickory Nut Cap.
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is that basically we are on the very southeastern corner of Buncombe County, which is the county that is Asheville. And behind us is a gorge, the Hickory Nut Gorge.
Oh.
So there's a gap in the mountain right there between us and the Hickory Nut Gorge, and that's called Hickory Nut Gap. And so in the old days, in like the 1800s, there was an old drover's road that came through here. And there's an old house on the farm that was built in the 1830s as an inn. And so that was a layover for folks, or a stopover, sort of a one day's travel from Asheville. And it was a very frequent way for folks that were traveling to the east to come. So they would come right through there.
Mm.
And Hickory Nut Gap Farm is just where it all came from.
Right. Now they can stop over and come to the farm.
They can come to the farm and visit and see some pigs and chickens and eat a really good hamburger. And probably my kids will be running around because that's what they do nowadays. Come down to the farm store and they get some beef sticks and just do their thing. So, yeah, it's fun. I've got a lot of family around here. You know, I just feel like we're lucky to be able to do what we do every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. And come visit sometime.
Definitely. Thank
all
you.
Right.
Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. I'll see you next week. The Farm Report is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.